Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
One, two, three, four. One, two.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. Cause I'm the tax man.
Beatles and Taxman, and that's from their seventh studio album, Revolver, released on the 5th of August in 1966 on Parlophone Records.
Well, I really don't like the stereo version of these because I think they all stink, the way that they've been mixed, but you know, that's all we could get hold of because to actually rip it from our vinyl is a bit tricky at the moment. But it's... we do have it in vinyl monitor, and it sounds fantastic. It's very direct, you know, and I don't think it was ever designed to be, you know, to be mixed like that. But anyway, you know, the pseudo stereo was all the rage in those days. But this is a show not about the Beatles. It's a show about Paul McCartney, and more specifically, his bass playing. Now, there's been a little bit of, there's been a revolt in the Starlight Campbell household due to the amount of guitar, the guitar things over the past 93 show. This is our 93rd show. So there's a lot of guitar talk and not enough bass talk, according to Starlight, which I totally agree with. And therefore, we've decided to feature, last week we did, well, the week before we did Carl Radle, and this week we are doing Paul McCartney.
Yes. So. Indeed.
The Beatles.
Paul McCartney.
Yes.
Bassman. I wanted to look at Paul from a completely different perspective, I guess. Everybody talks about how wonderful the Beatles were, and there's so many sources of information. But really, even though I knew that he was Bass Player of the Year for years running, I never really thought about him as being a bass player. I mean, when I started learning guitar when I was about 16, I was playing the Beatles songs, and I never thought about Paul McCartney being a bass player. I thought about him writing songs with John Lennon.
Mm.
So it's an interesting perspective I've got on him in terms of how I view him. So I thought, oh, let's have a look at him from the viewpoint of playing bass, you know. And so so I've done a little bit of research, and there's been some really nice interviews with, and they've just been focusing on the bass with him. So should we start at the very beginning?
Let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start.
James Paul McCartney.
Ah.
Was born on the 18th of June in 1942 in Walton Hospital in Liverpool. And Paul's dad bought him a nickel-plated trumpet for one of his birthdays. I think it was his 14th. And in those days, like, the trumpet was seen as a kind of heroic instrument. But he wanted to sing as well as play. So he asked his dad if he could trade in for a guitar instead. So his dad was okay with that because he was an amateur musician himself. He played in a band called Jim Mack's Jazz Band in the 20s.
Wow.
So Paul traded in his trumpet for a Framus Zenith Model 17 guitar for £15. And he only realised when he got at home that it was right-handed. And he, of course, he's left-handed, which is something I'd never really thought about or brought into my consciousness. And there were no rule books at the time, and he didn't know what to do until he saw a poster in a music mag of Slim Whitman. And he realised he had his guitar in the wrong way round. So he thought, that's how you do it. So he put it the other way around. He swapped the strings around, but because the holes were different sizes, he had to chip some bits of matchstick off and try and plug the holes up. And he could never move the nut. So it was one of those things where, because in those days, you know, you remember when the stories of when he was a kid and he was like learning guitar and somebody knew about how to play a B6 chord or something.
B7.
So they jumped on a bus.
Yeah,
was it him and George?
That's right. Yeah. Went over to see him play it. This B7 chord.
So we're looking at Liverpool. We're looking at this time when, if you look about Paul's education, he was one of and there are three other people in out of 90 odd people in his school that passed the 11 plus, which meant that he went to the grammar school.
Wow.
So he had a really kind of a privileged education in that respect, you know, because when you pass your 11 plus, it's a different world, isn't it, really? Mm. So, and you've got this scene where you've got the dockyards, you've got the music coming into Liverpool docks, and I love those kind of eras of, like, you know, when people treasured vinyl, they treasured the music, and they would trade the new single for a pack of fags.
Mm.
And then they go back and they play it on their stereo system. And the what I love about this era as well, possession necessarily wasn't what it was all about. You used to buy the albums, but you'd swap with your mates.
Yeah,
so everybody, you'd go around and listen, wouldn't you?
Brilliant.
So,
well, I didn't do it because it's a bit early,
you know,
for me, all that sort of activity.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was, but it was rife in those days, wasn't it? And very good, a really good thing to do because people were hanging out listening to music together, you know, which is great.
It was valued. So talking about the bass, throughout the 60s and earlier, the bass was really mostly viewed as a rhythm instrument and a bridge between the drums and the guitars, intended to provide some kind of low-end sound and flesh out chords and things. And aside from the occasional solo, like, you know, if you think about the Who's My Generation, the bass is really just stayed in the background. But Paul started playing bass by accident, really, by default, because Stuart Sutcliffe, who was the bass player in the band, the only reason he was the bass player was he'd won a painting competition for 75 quid and nobody could afford to buy a bass. So they went to the Casbah. Pete Best mums ran a coffee bar. Whatever.
That's the original drummer, Pete Best.
Yeah, yeah. And they persuaded Stuart Sutcliffe to use his prize money, which should have gone towards paints and things, to buy a bass. Which is so cool. So he ended up buying this bass, and then they went over and did some dates in Hamburg, and then Stuart Sutcliffe fell in love with a beautiful lady called Astrid and decided to leave the band. And when they'd gone over, Paul had ended up playing piano because he got his really cheap guitar fell apart. When they got to Hamburg, can you imagine these kids, right? Yeah. It's like his guitar fell apart, so he ended up having to play piano because he didn't have an instrument. So when Stuart left the band,
they
looked at him and just went, you'll have to do it, because he couldn't really say, no, I want to be the guitarist, because he didn't have a guitar.
Well, that's marvellous. I mean, it's a great story. And of course, this Revolver was the final recording they did before they retired as live performers,
yeah.
You know. And we're going to play quite a bit from his career in total. But the interesting thing about this track And the B-side from the single, which we're going to listen to a bit later on, is the fact that Jeff Emerick, of course, the famous and sadly missed, because he died very recently, recorded it. Because, you know, George Martin may have been the producer, and he did arrangements and helped with vocal harmonies and all that sort of stuff, brass instrumentation. But it was Jeff Emerick that really captured the sound of the Beatles. He was the mastermind behind the sound, no doubt about it. And with this track, what he did, he came up with a very bizarre thing of using it. You see them all the time now, a speaker in front of the bass cabinet to pick up the bass, the low end of the bass. So what they did is, instead of using a microphone, he thought, well, a microphone is just an inverted speaker, which it is.
Yeah.
Right? So what they did, he put a speaker in front of the other speaker, and everybody thought he was barking mad because, you know, they couldn't believe it. And he managed to beg, steal and borrow the gear to do it from, you know, from the studio. And he put it together, and it worked, and it gave a lot of low end. And by this time, Paul was using Rickenbacker, and you can hear it, a lot more punchy and flatwind strings. And, you know, and that's how this track, that's the sound of it. And it's a beautiful sound, you know. Paperback writer. The Beatles, of course, and Paperback Writer, released as the A-side of their 11th single in May 1966 on Parlophone and the UK on Capitol Records in the USA. It topped single charts in the UK, the United States, Ireland, West Germany, basically everywhere. on the US Billboard Hot 100, it was number one for two consecutive weeks. Being interrupted by Frank Sinatra. Strangers in the Night.
Strangers in the Night.
The thing is, though, it never, of course, made the Revolver album, even though it was recorded at the same session, because it was a very strange time then, is that, you know, singles were the big thing.
Yeah.
And yet it was a single, but you didn't put it on the album. And it's quite remarkable, you know, that. And you know, you might get a B-side, but that's it. But again, great bass playing. Really, really, and a great tone. And I think Jeff Emerick mentioned in his book a similar technique on this song as well with the bass.
Yeah.
And just something else about his gear incidentally at this time, because, you know, I've done
Do
some
tell.
Research into this.
I can tell. You've been teasing me and waving that book around.
Day.
I know.
I mean, yeah. He was using the Rickenbacker, but of course he used to use Vox amps, and that was the thing. And even now I think he still uses Vox amps with different cabinets, but he used the Vox AC100. Which is a 100-watt valve head, through a cabinet, which is a very strange thing, with a 1x12 speaker and a 115 at the bottom. I think it's called the T60. I think it was called the Vox T60. So it was like
in English. So what does all that mean?
Well, what it means is that a smaller speaker, a 12, like you would get used on a guitar generally.
Yeah.
And a 15, which was more bass. You sort of get more low end out of a 15.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it was, and he's seen with these all the time. You know, he loved that. But there is definitely a sound there, and I think in some of the later recordings that we're going to hear later. You can hear some distortion in his sound, you know, because, you know, they were pushing it. And those speakers weren't right good, really, to tell you the truth, in those days.
Yeah.
And, you know, with a 100-watt amp on the back of it, it used to distort a bit. Anyway, so they are. A little bit about his amps.
So the reason why this... Jeff, our friend Jeff, has said this is the first time the bass sound had been heard in all its excitement. So you've got Paul on his Rickenbacker. Plus, he used that speaker...
That's right.
Speaker technique.
Thing, yeah.
Also, Paul was playing more melodic and busier than on previous songs. But also, it was partly in response to John Lennon, because he wanted to know why the bass on a certain Wilson Pickett record was louder than the bass on any of their records.
Well, you know, one of the reasons why, and I know quite a lot about this after reading this book, with Jeff Emery book, which is called Here, There and Everywhere, incidentally, is an essential read,
yeah.
Is the fact that it was the mastering. Because when they were cutting it to lacquers, it was the inability of the engineers at Abbey Road and most people in England to actually get the bass loud enough on the record.
Yeah.
And because, if you know anything about LPs and records, if you put too much bass on a vinyl record, the needle actually physically jumps out.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had to be careful. And being Abbey Road, of course, you know, they were, you know, it's EMI and they're very strict about the amount of everything that they did, you know, the mic techniques, who messed around with the mics, who placed them, everything else. And that was the problem. But when Paul McCartney was looking at this, he said he wanted it more Motown, which is sort of that thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't realise, I said that again, I'm allowed to say it once in every show.
Okay.
James Jamerson was one of his heroes.
Wow.
Which makes sense, really.
Of course.
But also, EMI, the maintenance department, they had developed a mastering process referred to as automatic transient overload control.
Right. Which I think is...
Allowed them to cut louder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically a compressor or a limiter. That's what they're actually called, because that's exactly what you're doing with a limiter, you know. You're just basically squashing it so it doesn't go any louder, and eventually it just hits a brick wall at the volume.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, they're used all the time now, you know. But what I love about these tracks, and I'm looking at it on our Pro Tools system here, and I look at the track and you can see the dynamic range, which is basically the amount of loudness or quietness in a track. And you can see the waveform actually moving around. And a lot of modern records, it's just a big block because everything's been squashed to death. But this, it's got so much
life. It's like a heartbeat,
isn't it? And it sounds so good. Yeah, it sounds still so good. I mean, that's a lot better mix, I think, than the stereo rendition than the last track. But anyway, it's marvellous.
And also, one other thing, just to evoke the picture of this time with the Beatles, you know, they were still going through for many years, through the back door, through the tradesman's entrance into the studio. All the EMI employees had different coloured sort of long, what were they, those jackets, those long overalls, like
the brown
very formal.
Ones were the engineers.
That's right, yeah, yeah,
the,
yeah.
The actual maintenance engineers, and the white overalls were the actual studio engineers.
And they were never allowed up into the control room. Apparently, it may be of an evening, George Martin might just pop on the mic and say, "Would you like to come up and have a listen, chaps?" And he'd go, "All right, mister, that's great."
Be it.
The Beatles and Come Together, the opening track on their 11th studio album, Abbey Road. And that was released on the 26th of September in 1969 in the UK, and 5 days later in the USA on the Apple record label. And it was also released as a double A-sided single coupled with Something on the 6th of October in 69. And the single was in the Billboard Hot 100 charts for 16 weeks, where it reached the top of the charts in the USA and peaked at number 4 in the UK.
Hardly surprising. And you can see a stark contrast in the production there, or the technical sort of sound of the band. You know, there's a lot more space in there. The kick drum's sensational. I love the kick drum sound on that. Jeff Emmerich was a genius.
Yeah.
And because Jeff Emmerich actually had a break from being with the Beatles, of course. He quit one day due to the fact it was all going wrong. You know, it was all...
The atmosphere was awful, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And this essentially is the last album that they did. Really, even though the last one was Let It Be, the last one, but a lot of that stuff on Let It Be was recorded before Abbey Road, so it's sort of a bit of a mess. And it's the only the last album that they all appeared on together. And apparently, John Lennon did most of this. Mm-hmm. He did all the backing vocals because they weren't really speaking very much, to tell you the truth.
No.
But the bass—it's all about the bass. This track, isn't it?
It's fantastic. If you hear the isolated track, when I listened to that the other day, it's quite lovely.
You've been listening to the isolated tracks?
Well, yeah.
Come on.
You pointed it out to me as well.
You are.
Hang
well,
on.
I know. I didn't think you'd listen to it. I thought you... I just pointed it. I said, why didn't you listen? You've been secretly... It's like...
Well, that's quite interesting, you know.
Audio porn
well,
for
you
a
don't
bass
really
player.
Get to understand how things work. And then you go, oh, so that's what you're playing then, Sunshine, you know?
Yeah, it's beautiful sound, though. Really beautiful sound, you know?
Well, I didn't know about John Lennon writing this song as a request from... The famous Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary's dead.
Yeah. So he was running a campaign to become governor of California against Ronald Reagan. And apparently it ended when, Timothy Leary was sent to prison for possession of marijuana. Mm. So Timothy Leary was the guy that was experimental with LSD and drugs and stuff. And we've watched a documentary on him, and the Moody Blues sang a song.
That's Timothy right. Leary's dead. Yeah.
He's somewhere in orbit around planet Earth. His ashes are in some kind of rocket or some sort of...
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. So he's literally circumnavigating the globe, as it were, in space, which is kind of weird, hey? So the song, they created the song in the studio, and Lennon said it was just really gobbledygook. Come Together was an expression that Leary had come up with for his attempt at being president, or, you know, obviously his campaign. Ah. And he wanted John to write the song. He said he tried, and he kept on trying, but he just couldn't come up with one. So he came up with this song, which would have done him no good as a campaign song, really, because it's just full of gobbledygook.
Yeah, but I love the Wurlitzer on that. It's a beautiful sound, absolutely gorgeous sound. But the whole thing about the bass on this record, it's impossible to imagine it
without that
line.
It's true, actually.
Because, you know, it shows elements of McCartney's play. Oh, sugar. the ability to craft a melody, the ability to blend into a background, the heaviness, the lightness, it's all there, wrapped perfectly to counterbalance Lennon's growl vocals and craft a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Marvellous, you know?
Have you heard the Robin Williams version of that? George Martin released an album called In My Life.
That's right, yeah.
And Robin Williams does the version of this song. And it's brilliant. He does all the sound effects.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't think I've heard it. I've just banged the microphone stand because we've now got a new console.
We have.
We've had a bit of a swap around of the control room. So I'm now peering over a screen at Starlight here.
I can just see, literally, you're like one of those characters, you know, where the nose appears over the wall and you just got a pair of eyes. That's all I can see. It's a bit odd.
Yeah, that's great. I can't remember what it's called. My dad used to draw those all the time. But we're behind us a beautiful 56-frame Kadak console with the cream of British audio engineering.
Well, basically, in laywoman and man's terms, it's a big, big console, and it's got, you know, all those faders and things. It's got lovely wood front to it, and it's analog, and we're going to record our next album and loads of albums with it. So we're just very,
very excited.
Very excited.
1, 2, 3, 4. Well, she was just 17.
So standing there, the opening track from their debut album, Please Please Me, released on 26th of December in 1963 on Capitol Records. It released a song in the United States, the B-side to I Wanna Hold Your Hand, which is fair enough, I suppose.
Yeah.
And while I Wanna Hold Your Hand topped the US Billboard chart for 7 weeks, starting the 1st of February 1964, I Saw Her Standing There entered the Billboard Hot 100 on the 8th of February 1964 and stayed there for 11 weeks, peaking at number 14. And this was engineered by Norman Smith.
Yes.
Now you can tell the difference. And I'm sorry, Norm, you're actually very clean, very clear engineer, but it didn't have that fat sound, did it? Of course,
no.
63, but, you know, you listen to what Tom Dowd was doing in 1963 and then listen to this. So it's very raw, but great bass line.
Yeah.
Nicked wholesale.
It's true.
From a Chuck Berry song. Is that right?
That's
talking
right.
About you.
He fessed up to that as well. I didn't know about that. He was saying that he tells people that he used the bass riff from Talking About You by Chuck Berry, but he said people don't believe him. He said, even now, I tell people that, you know, he basically copied it note for note and that nobody believes him. So he basically came to the conclusion that a bass riff doesn't have to be original.
No, well, you know, it. The thing is, it doesn't. You know,
depends on its role in the song.
Yeah, that's right. It's all about serving the song. And if you can, I mean, you listen to virtually every country record that's ever been created. Do.
It's true,
one,
actually.
5-1,
and it makes me want to do that. Put your arms up like a farmer going
right.
down the street.
I think you have a bass story, though.
Well, yeah. So I wanted to just carry on with this little bit of a story of Paul. So he found out that he was the bass player. And really, the bass player in a band in those days wasn't sexy. He usually said it was like the overweight guy that stood in the back. Girls weren't playing bass at that point, really, not in any way. Or there might be the odd lady playing, but really, and
what about Carole Kay? She came a bit later, though, didn't she?
Yeah,
anyway.
She was in the Wrecking Crew and she was in the LA
States.
Studio scene.
Yeah.
But in terms of a live band, I don't think she was part of a live band. I don't think you saw many female bass players
in the
band.
Definitely not.
No.
She's the only one I can think of. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, so he was just saying, right, okay, but he took it really seriously. And they were saying that when they were actually recording, because when Norman did this session, they basically, George Martin went to see them live at the Cavern and he said, right, okay, come into the studio and we'll just record the whole lot. They did 14 songs in one day.
Wow.
And that's why he said he wanted it to sort of sound like they were a live band, which they were. So 10 out of the 14 songs they recorded on that day are on Please Please Me.
Flipping it.
So he was saying, though, this is lovely, right? So he's saying, they weren't really deadly serious, and they weren't that fussy about being perfect in those days, those early days. So saying if the producer didn't hear a mistake, they never fessed up to it. They'd just go, shh. And he'd say, good take, boys. And they'd go, okay, right, George, you know, kind of thing. So he said they had this energy because of that as well, I think, because it wasn't perfection and they didn't have too much time to work on it anyway. So he said, once you've realised that, when you understand the role of the bass, you actually realise that you've got control of the band.
Yeah.
You're saying they can't go anywhere without you.
That's right, totally.
Which is weird, because I'd never thought about it like that before. But he's then started to identify with other bass players. And when he met Elvis Presley, Elvis was learning bass.
No.
Yeah. And he actually said to him, oh, I hear that you're trying to learn bass, are you, son? Sit down, let me show you a few things. So he taught Elvis a little bit of bass action.
Amazing.
Listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Something from the Beatles' 11th studio album again, Abbey Road. And, you know, people say that the bass is understated on that. I mean, it's very loud in the mix and it's a magnificent part. And the thing that gets me about that, it sounds like each individual member of the band, even, and I know they weren't really together at that point, really, but they sound individual. It sounds like a lot of individuals playing together, if you know what I mean. Because he's not really keying in with the drums, is he, there, you know?
Just feel like he's the bass. For me, I find it a little bit busy in places.
Mm.
And I think even Paul McCartney was saying that he was just trying to serve the song, and maybe it was his turn for George Harrison to tell him he was a bit busy, you know.
Well, it's a beautiful
part.
It
is beautiful.
And I love you can hear that distortion, because it's a little loud. You can hear that distortion from the amp in there and the speaker. You know, it just sounds really great. But without that bass, it wouldn't be the same song, because it really might be a bit busy, but he's doing it like a counterpoint melody all the way through.
It is magnificent, and it's very emotional, actually. It makes you feel.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Isn't it? Absolutely beautiful. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But do you, don't you want me to love you?
The Beatles, Helter Skelter, from their ninth studio album, The Beatles, a double album also known as The White Album. And that was released on the 22nd of November in 1968 in the UK and 3 days later in the US of A on Apple Records.
Written by Paul completely, I believe.
Yep.
Amazing.
All because he read an article, an interview with Pete Townshend. And The Who. And Pete described their latest single, I Can See for Miles, as the loudest, rawest, dirtiest song that Who had ever recorded.
Right. And this is loud and dirty and roaring.
Yeah. So he wanted to do something dirtier.
Well,
louder.
Yeah, people say it's like proto-metal.
I don't
And it's now, yeah, proto metal, proto whatever.
Honestly,
it is.
I just think it's a joke phrase when people say
well,
that.
Well, I know it's getting worse. Everybody's
it's like
using it.
Those goons, those, you know, teen movies where you've got those geeky goon type characters that go, "Yeah, man, that's a real proto metal." Yeah, and it just doesn't. I can't take it seriously.
I remember incidentally the guy that looks over the wall. He was called Chad with his nose hanging over the face from the war. I
right.
Anyway,
okay.
But yeah, I mean, the bass on that is absolutely ferocious. Using obviously the bridge pickup, which is a lot more trebly.
Yeah.
A lot of compression on there, which is basically reducing the amount of dynamic range between quiet and loud. So it's really punching through and dirty. It sounds great.
Yeah.
And but he was trying to compete with John Entwistle
exactly.
here?
Yeah, John Thunderfingers Entwistle. Who were? I mean, I think he just wanted to do his version. They say that some reviewers have said, oh, you can hear sort of elements of John Paul Jones from Led Zeppelin and Geezer Butler's work with Black Sabbath in that as well. I don't know, really. It was odd, though, because I don't really know that song that well. I was a bit taken aback. You know, we just sit there and listen to it. It's like, what, really? This is Paul McCartney?
Mm.
Well, odd.
But everything, I mean, and I love it. I love the fact that everything's angry about it, you know. It's got a lot of, you know, the drums are slightly distorted, you know.
Yeah.
But Ringo's really going for it there, you know.
They did loads and loads of takes, and I think take three lasted 27 minutes.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I think by about take 31, Ringo like threw his drumsticks across the room and said, "I've got blisters. Can we stop?" And apparently his shouts included on one remix or something. And in the meantime, you've got George Harrison running around with an ashtray he'd set on fire. We put on top of his head and he was doing an Arthur Brown impersonation.
Oh, fantastic. That's amazing. You can just imagine it, can't you?
Yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. People eat marshmallow pies. Everyone smiles as you drift past the flowers that grow so incredibly high. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore, waiting to take you. Train in a station with plasticine pauses with looking glass ties. Suddenly someone is there at the turnstile. The girl with kaleidoscope eyes. We'll be right back.
few little fills at the end by Paul there. It sounded a little bit out of tune, actually. I've just noticed it. So you see with his intonation on his Rickenbacker bass. But Lucy and the Scarlet Diamonds from the Rage Studios album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, released on 26th of May 1967 on Parlophone Records, and George Martin's favourite record. He said it was a masterpiece. I like the record. We've got it, of course, on vinyl. It sounds great. But I think it's other Beatles stuff that I prefer, to tell you the truth, than that album. But the bass on this is it wouldn't be the same without a bass. It's very loud in the mix, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's I think at this point, when I read an interview with Paul, he was just saying he was just starting to realise he didn't have to just do the solid root notes. He could actually do independent melodies. And he was really into experimenting. He just wanted to know what was possible. So I think that kind of got his fascination up. And you can really hear that. And I think it's very makes the song in a way. But I thought, I didn't know that the song was written about Lucy O'Donnell, because Julian Lennon was 3 years old at the time and he'd drawn a picture of his classmate called Lucy, and he called it Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, a lovely tale.
That's lovely, isn't
it? I didn't
know
that.
But the BBC still banned it because they said that Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was LSD. It was an acronym for that. And so basically they banned it because they said it's covert drug song.
Well, Emmerich in Here, There and Everywhere, you know, again, they worked so hard on this record. And later on, Paul McCartney, which I didn't know, because I thought they all played together, even on these sort of things, you know, when they were putting it together. But that's not true. He used to come in at night, Paul McCartney, yeah, reading the bass, note by note.
Yeah.
Now, doing that with tape is really hard. It's very easy to make a mistake, very easy to erase something, you know, unless you're right on it in these late sessions. But amazing, and it still sounds great. The bass sounds fantastic. But, you know, talking about, everybody talks about it's Hofner bass, don't they, the violin bass?
Yeah, the first one was called the Cavern bass. That got stolen from one of their sessions at EMI, actually.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they still don't know to this day where it is. There's some kind of myth that there's some guy in Ottawa, it was called the Keepers, got it, and it's just like there are myths all going about who's got his first bass. So anyway, Hofner gave him a second bass because obviously he'd help launch the brand, hadn't he? It just went massive.
Right.
But it used to go out of tune, and it used to really be embarrassing for him, you know.
Yeah,
so he had some work done on it a few years ago, actually, because he still got that one. But yeah, it wasn't quite right, so he kind of tended towards the Rickenbacker a bit as well in the studio.
Well, the Rickenbacker, I mean, it has got a very distinctive sound, and bass players over the years have used them extensively, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, John Squire from Yes, you know, lots of people. Lemmy, of course, the mighty Lemmy. Lots of people use those.
I guess
bases.
it's what attitude you want, isn't it? Depending on what bass you pick up, because I'm starting to appreciate that a lot more now with the different basses that I've got. It just gives a different attitude.
You're
ever
growing stable, darling.
Yeah, it's a bit much, really, but I'm very, very happy. The Beatles. Ray! Yeah, released in May 1966 as the B-side of their Paperback Writer single on the Parlophone and Capitol Record labels.
Mmm. Well, you know, I can hear on the end of that.
What?
They had to use a six-string bass.
And don't swear.
I can hear it. Yeah, but I can hear it because it's they used it quite a lot, you know. The Fender 6-string bass, you can hear it. It's really low. And it's very interesting because they used to stick that in a lot. But the bass line is fantastic on that, you know. And I'm pretty sure that Bruce Foxton from The Jam was listening to this when they did quite a few of their songs, actually. But I won't mention anything for fear of a nasty lawsuit ensuing. Anyway, there we are.
Right, I get it. It sounds very Eastern as well, doesn't it? It's got that kind of mode feel to it, that kind of trance-like Eastern feel.
And a marvellous, I mean, Ringo's going mad there, really, you know, very aggressive drums on the whole thing, isn't it, you know?
And this is the first time that they used reverse sounds in a pop song.
Is that right?
Yeah. And they used the same technique on the Revolver track, Tomorrow Never Knows, and that was released a couple of months later. But Rain includes backward vocals.
Yeah, and I can hear some Leslie guitar on there as well. That's a guitar to a Leslie, which is a rotating speaker thing, very fast.
You can always imagine, can't you, now, after that then, Jeff was saying that, you know, after that, the discovery, everything had to be tried forwards and backwards. Because this is the picture that I'm getting. These lads, you know, they were experimenters. They just wanted, they thought in terms of singles. They didn't think in terms of albums. And so, because any song could be pulled off an album and released as a single.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, that's really where they're up to. And you don't realise just how experimental they were.
Oh, well, yeah.
It's quite, because we're so used to them. We're so used to the sounds. But in those days, they were new.
Mm. Well, Jeff Emmerich, they used to go with the idea, but Jeff, you know, made it possible, you know, by his excellence and his skill, you know.
Yeah. So it's the end of the show.
No.
And,
I could have carried on for another half an hour.
I didn't think I would. I've really, really enjoyed this. And it's kind of, I've got like a connection with Paul McCartney now that's different. Then, like, you know, this Beatlemania thing that's gone on, it's really kind of helped me sort of connect with him as a musician from a bass perspective. So we're going to play you out this week's show with a song called Dear Prudence from the White Album. And it was written about Mia Farrow's sister, who was called Prudence. And apparently she was really obsessed with meditation when they were all in India. And so it was a tease to get her out of her room because she... So this is what that's about anyway. And I hope you've really enjoyed it. And when Paul was talking about their time as a band, he said it was just this beautiful innocence that you had. They were just about discovering it all, making it up as they went along. And there wasn't an awful lot to think about. And which he thinks is always a good thing. The more time you've got to think about it, the more time you've got to worry. And he just liked trusting your instincts. Like, right, you're on. Holy shit. Then you're off.